RCR with Paul Brennan, Reality Check Radio.
It's time for our Legal Hub Wednesday morning, and it's my great pleasure to welcome back after a long gap, Nick Kearney, lawyer Nick Kearney. Nick, welcome back. It's great to hear from you again.
Good morning, Paul, and good morning to all of your listeners. It's good to be back.
Now, you've been busy?
Yeah, I've been busy. I've had a bit going on in my life. I've decided to venture into my own business again. So I've purchased a law practice on the North Shore of Auckland, and as a sole practitioner, been around 30-odd years, wants to retire. So I've decided he needs to move out. I need to move in, take over his clients, bring mine with me, and that's build an empire, basically. So that's what I've been doing.
Built the last
3 to 6 months, and started yesterday, actually, and it's already started with a bit of a hiss and a roar. It's good. It's really good.
All right, we're here to talk about, well, two things that are kind of related. Did you hear, speaking on this program a couple of weeks ago now, the Te Pāti Māori MP Te Kuta Ferris talking about his proposed Treaty of Waitangi Empowerment of Waitangi Tribunal Amendment Bill? Did you hear that?
I listened to a lot of the interview, but not all of it. Yes, I did, yeah.
What did you make of what you heard?
I guess the first thing, I've not heard of Te Kuta Ferris before. I thought he was very eloquent, and I guess my initial impression was a little bit contradictory in that it's like, well, if someone is eloquent and obviously intelligent as that is in Parliament, that's a good thing for the country, and we should be debating his ideas, and his idea is utter lunacy. So I had the juxtaposition myself to think, how could someone so seemingly intelligent and eloquent propose such a ludicrous idea?
Yeah, he did speak well. Making Waitangi Tribunal decisions binding, what does that say about how they think about Parliament, do you think?
Well, our system relies on Parliament being the highest court in the land, no court in the land, right from down tenancy tribunal to disputes tribunal to district courts to any other tribunal, High Court, Court of Appeal, or Supreme Court. None of those courts can bind Parliament. They make a decision, and ultimately, if Parliament does not like the decision that was made and how it was ruled, Parliament can pass a law to overturn it. And we've seen that a couple of times in the last 20 years. Parliament very rarely does that. Helen Clark did it with the foreshore and seabed. There wasn't actually a decision there, but she saw what was coming, I think, and proposed put in place the foreshore and seabed legislation. You're seeing now Paul Goldsmith legislating against a Court of Appeal decision that gave greater rights to iwi over the foreshore and seabed again, or marine and coastal areas. So he's going to, or the government is proposing to legislate to overturn that decision. But it doesn't happen very often. Mostly Parliament respects the decisions of the courts, because Parliament is, another branch of the judiciary, so to speak, and the executive, and likes to stay separate of the court system. But in some instances, it will say we can't have this in our country, and it will pass a law to overturn it. Now, whatever decision that might be, Mr. Ferris is proposing is that this cannot happen, and this is not what would happen with Waitangi Tribunal decisions. They would be binding on Parliament, binding on the Crown, and if those decisions required legislation to correct, a wrong, then the Parliament would have to pass that legislation to effect the Waitangi Tribunal decision, and that's it just goes against everything that our constitutional system is made up of, really.
He seemed to have, to me anyway, and I'm not being condescending, just quite a simplistic view of everything. They didn't really take account of the rest of us. I made the comment at the time that it seemed like he was viewing it as some kind of sporting contest. We had two teams on each side. You could pick your side, and one would win, and kind of that was it. Which, like I say, is so overly simplistic. It's kind of not credible to me, anyway.
No, they don't like this current Māori Party don't like playing the game by the inverted commas or the rules that we have, I suppose, or the system that we have, which is interestingly, it's quite contradictory because they're trying to use Parliament to introduce a law that would assert the role of Parliament. And they're using Parliament, you know, that they don't actually believe that Parliament suits its purposes, but they're using it to try and, you know, suit its purpose. So a little bit hypocritical, I suppose. But they do. This current, you know, the current Māori Party, in my view, I think, and particularly some of the radicals that that kind of feed into it and feed off it, very... They don't respect the parliamentary Westminster system. They don't respect. I mean, Māori have turned up in the courts for as long as I can remember and said this court is not binding on me. You know, I have this court has no authority over me because I'm Tangata Whenua, I'm Indigenous, and and Māori have even in the past tried to introduce their own passports. You know, if you remember, birth certificates, I guess certificates of, you want to call it citizenship or something like that. They've tried to do that. You know, they also want their own parliament. They want a separate parliament for Māori as well. So they look at it. You're right. They look at it as a contest, and the contest is. Based on race and culture, and one that you know they're pretty obviously keen to win.
Yeah, you're talking about you know passports and birth certificates. There was never any kind of nation structure anyway, so all that's just appropriation of other cultures, which is something I think is objected to by them.
Well, that's what I mean, and so you know they don't. They don't respect or the way the legal system works in the country, the constitutional makeup, which necessarily includes having a passport issued by the DIA to prove that you're a citizen of this country or whatever. They don't respect that system at all. They don't want it. In fact, if they could throw it out tomorrow in the rubbish bin and burn the whole thing down, they would. But then they want to have their own one for themselves. So this is what I mean. It's a little bit contradictory if they. Sort of, I'd probably have a bit more respect for them if they stood by the, had a bit of honour with what they actually believe in and didn't abide by the system or the rules because that's kind of what they think, but they kind of do, then they want to have their own system too. So it's, look, I mean, the other aspect of this, I mean, we're talking about, you know, having Parliament overturn legislation, overturn court decisions. I've spoken on this program many times over the Alice decision and how it impacts in respect of tikanga. And look, it cuts both ways. Tikanga, we've actually talked about an employment case at Customs, didn't we? That in favour of the employee who won the case because they argued tikanga and got home on it. But I think if Paul Goldsmith has moved to overturn the Marine and Coastal. A decision from the Court of Appeal of a couple of years ago, then I also think that they should legislate to overturn the decision in Alice as it relates to tikanga as well, because...
Oh, okay.
What that is doing and is going to do, if we allow it to creep along in the way it is, it's going to create two separate legal systems. One based on iwi Māori, cultural systems, which isn't based on any principles whatsoever, and then our common law, our Westminster system.
Let's map out what it could be like if Waitangi Tribunal decisions were binding, because the way that Takuta Ferris put it, like I said, there are two teams, and get your best team up, we'll get our best team up, and you know the best argument wins. But we know that a lot of the judiciary now, and this is just like a thought experiment, I guess, in a way. Activist in, we've talked about tikanga, the Ellis case, and there are others, the case with the chap who chopped down One Tree Hill, Mike Smith, was it? And his invocation of tikanga around pollution with some of the big companies, and we talked about that earlier. But even if this thing flew, we couldn't rely on our side, could we, if we're making sides, because of their activism anyway?
I'm struggling to recall a decision of the Waitangi Tribunal which went against the iwi that made the claim.
Okay.
So I think the Waitangi Tribunal was heavily in favour of iwi and the tribe that make the claims in front of them. I don't think they've ever ruled, and I could be wrong here, and someone can point out to me if I'm wrong, but I'm glad to accept I am wrong, but I can't recall a time where the Waitangi Tribunal has ruled against an iwi hapu taking a claim and ruled in favour of the Crown. I'm fairly certain most of the cases taken to the tribunal are found are ruled in favour of the iwi, and then recommendations are made to the Crown, which is how it should be, you know. So, look, judges and courts make decisions every day on, not every day, but you know, regularly, particularly around issues to do with Bill of Rights and constitutional issues, and they know that they can't overreach their power, and they make recommendations to the Crown around perhaps changing, you know, Parliament, perhaps changing a law here or there, or that, you know, there's been, I mean, that we had happened during some of the COVID decisions. There were declarations made that the Crown breached, you know, breached the Bill of Rights Act or whatever else, or, you know, other, you know, legislate. I think that, you know, the first...
Actually, I mentioned that to him. I made a point about that to him, and he just brushed it off like it meant nothing.
Yeah, because they don't want to play by that game. You see, they don't want the Waitangi Tribunal to say to the Crown, hey, we think that, or Parliament, hey, we think that, you know, you've done something wrong here, which is what they do now. Hey, we think you've done something wrong here. You should right that wrong by doing this. And look, for over 30 years or more, actually, Parliament's done a pretty good job, and most governments have done a pretty good job of trying to right the wrongs. And let's not pretend there were no wrongs. You know, there have been some egregious wrongs, theft of land and whatever. And this process was started by Doug Graham of the National Government. It wasn't started by, you know, by a Labor government. Started by Doug Graham, carried on by Chris Finlayson, the last John Key government, and then carried through with, you know, Labor governments in between as well, Helen Clark and the like. So successive governments have taken recommendations of the Waitangi Tribunal in regards to settlements of iwi's claims, and they have passed and just like they paid money, you know, Sea Lord claims, given them land back, Ngātahu down the South Island, and they've actually done it. So I don't actually know, and it's ongoing. It's actually ongoing, and who knows when it will end. I don't actually know what, you know, Takuto Ferris is trying to achieve by doing this, because I think he may even just actually be putting a huge big foot in his mouth with what he's trying to do.
Or it could be more strategic than that, because I think he said that he didn't think there's much hope of this, you know, flying at all. But what it does do is it kind of creates more tension in the division space, let's say, and that might serve some other purpose, maybe.
Yeah, and this will undoubtedly be a private members bill. It will go into the private members ballot, and that's drawn out, I don't know, is it every Tuesday or every second Tuesday or something? I think three of them get drawn out or something. So, you know, if it gets drawn out, and if it gets drawn out at the same time we're debating David Seymour's principles of Treaty Waitangi Bill or whatever, then goodness gracious, haven't we got a hell of a time ahead of us?
Yeah, the heat is on.
Yeah, and his wish of having an A and a B team or whatever you call it, or black and a white team, man, that'll be in reality for sure.
He also, he's called on the government or government parties to support the bill to maintain goodwill with Māori and preserve the foundation of their existence in Aotearoa. That existence, that foundation, I don't see it being threatened in any way. It just is what it is, isn't it?
Well, I was about to say, what's he talking about? I can't say being threatened. In fact, I saw a figure just a few weeks ago that apparently now there's almost 1 million people claiming to be Māori in New Zealand. You know, there's 900 and something thousand people claiming some sort of Māori heritage. That's a quarter of the population. How can Maori possibly be? There's almost a million of them, and it won't be 20% of the population, but almost a million of them. How can they claim to be threatened? I mean, yeah, it's look, no government will ever going to pick up a bill like this and run with it. It would completely overturn and disrupt, as I say, the Westminster system of and the separations of functions of power that we have between the parliament and the executive and the branches of government. It just can't run, you know.
Should we get on to the amendment to the Marine and Coastal Area Act now?
Sure. A related topic?
Yeah, well, it is. And I also asked Takuta Ferris about that. And obviously, the threshold for proving, well, going back to proving continuous exclusive use and occupation of the claimed area from 1840 to the present without substantial interruption, which I think was originally intended by Parliament. Well, he thought that raised the bar too high again.
Mr. Ferris did?
Yeah, he thought that was too high of a bar. But that's what you'd expect normally, isn't it? You can't just say, hey, we've kind of hung out here for a while.
Yeah, well, the threshold that they put in place by the Edwards decision, it was last year, I think, 2023, reduced it to being basically, I've got kind of, I think the words were effective control, even if there were constraints preventing iwi from showing exclusive use. So I've got effective control over this part of foreshore and seabed. Well, what sort of effective control do you have? I just control it. I control it. So I put a flag down one end of the beach, not a flag down the other, and we've got a couple of bros stand down the end. We tell people they can't walk down there, and we control it. We've got effective control. It's ours. I mean, is that what it means? I don't know. You know, I mean, it's a worry. Yeah, it's a worry. I think what they're doing here is a very good thing, to be honest. And again, it comes back to a concern that the likes of Stephen Franks have had, and certainly Gary Judd, of course, you've had him on the show about some of the higher courts in this land being quite activist in some of this area presently.
Yep.
The decision in 2023, there's no reason, there's no reason to reduce the threshold. Obviously, I mean, the thing about judges are this, that judges don't, I mean, you know, when I was at law school, we had a lecturer explained to us in the class that judges don't make the law, it's lawyers who make the law. So the lawyers stand up in front of the judge and make an argument saying this is what should happen, and the judges either agree or disagree. In most instances, sometimes they go a bit over the top and make their own law, but that's generally how it works. And so what's happened here, obviously, is that the Court of Appeal has preferred the argument of the iwi about the effective control rather than continuous possession and exclusive possession over the Crown's argument. So, look, the Crown lost, to use Mr. Ferris's analogy, you know, the Crown lost that game, that war, that battle, that match. So now they're just saying, well, we're not that happy about losing, so we're just going to legislate and overturn it. And that's completely contradictory to what he wants under the Waitangi Tribunal law that he proposes, because in that case, the Parliament could not legislate and overturn anything.
I'm just wondering, because I also had Shane Jones on, and I asked him, you know, the bigger picture, how do we unbundle all this, would you call it creep, all this creep that's happened over this time? I can't actually remember his particular answer, but I do remember him putting it in a way which kind of said to me that it's not going to be easy, you know?
It's not. There was, look, you may not remember this guy, but there was a man called Owen McShane, who was a commentator, and he was a resource management planner, I think, by occupation. But he appeared a lot on Leighton Smith News Talk ZB show in the mornings 20, 30 years ago. And very erudite and eloquent speaker on matters of matters like this. But he explained, Owen, that what he saw coming, this is about 20 years ago, he called it, Paul, cultural Marxism. And, and he said, if we don't stop the institutions being embedded by cultural Marxism, we have a major, major problem in the country. And, you know, you can, and this is, you know, so once you start with the courts, into the councils, into the schools, into the other, the hospitals, into the other public institutions, the police, with the cultural Marxism about, you know, and we don't have to go over the topics. This one's one of them. Transgenderism is another one. You know, she, he, correct pronouns, the use of, you know, mandatory te reo in a lot of government departments and government meetings in government departments. So I know of people who work for councils, and you can't go into a meeting at the council, you know, with council officers and legal people without introducing yourself in te reo and starting with a karakia. You can't do it. So every single meeting is led with a karakia and an introduction of the people in the room in te reo. And look, it's that's just one example. I'll just use te reo and Māoridom for that. But the as I call it, the cultural Marxism exists in many, many facets. And it, once it's in the institutions, it's I think it's impossible to unwind. And it requires a very, very strong government to do so, very strong. Because what you're seeing now as well is that not just do the public institutions take it all on, but your large corporates are also behaving the same way. And, you know, your banks and for that other, you know, massive corporates, businesses, et cetera, and it's just little things, I suppose. I mean, some of the – I get emails every day at work and stuff from, you know, corporate banks and what have you. And the sign-offs, the introductions are in, you know, out in te reo, you know, kia ora, Nick, at the end of Ngā Mihi. And then you got then you got she, her, they, them. And then, you know what I mean, et cetera. And it just goes on and on. And, what, and that's all fine. I mean, I value and respect every single individual person's in this country decision to speak how they want, to refer to themselves how they want, whatever. That's absolutely fine. I mean,
I agree with you. I'm on board.
Each to their own, you know. C'est la vie, each to their own. I've got no problem with any of that stuff at all. I'm very, very libertarian. Like that. I couldn't care. What I do oppose strongly is compulsion of all of that down everyone else's throat. That and that that compulsion aspect, the cultural Marxism aspect, this is how you shall behave, this is how you shall speak, this is how you shall address me. You know, it's a very, very dangerous way to go, very dangerous. And I've got a couple of a very good friend here in Auckland. She's Iranian, and she came here. She you should hear what she has to say about Gorries, but that might be for another show.
Another program.
But she's Iranian, and she came here when she was about 8 years old. She's 43 now, and she is petrified at the way this country is going, because she said it is the cultural Marxism is exactly what the cultural wars in Iran were fought over, and this is what this is where this country is going. She can see it, you know, because she's. She has seen it in her own country. There's another lawyer in Auckland I'm very friendly with, who, again, is Iranian, and she has written quite a bit about it in legal publications, and she's fearful of it as well. So I just use those two words, cultural Marxism, and it's embedded in institutions, and once it's embedded, it can be very hard to get rid of, and it's very troubling for a liberal democratic society like we have.
And it's embedded in the mainstream media, just saying it is.
Oh, 100%. I reckon. Yeah.
Which explains everything.
Yes. Yeah, and well, we've seen an example of it just last week with the Hobson's Pledge ad on the front page of the Herald. I have no allegiance to Hobson's Pledge. You know, they say what they want, they believe what they want about the foreshore and seabed and other stuff, Iwi taking over. That's all. I mean, that's each to their own, right? You know, like I say, they put an ad on the front page of the Herald. You can read it and believe it, or you choose not to.
Of course.
You know what I mean? You can read it and go, what a load of tripe. Or you can read it and go, oh, really? And take a bit of interest in it and research it and join them or not. Or you can roll the paper up and burn it and think, these guys are a bunch of racists. That's fine. But the fact that we've now got the mainstream, the Herald, saying, well, we can now look at our standards, we're not going to publish any more ads from these people or any other editorials from lobby groups like this, and advertising standard authority complaints. Bloody hell, man. I tell you, we saw this during, look what the Voices for Freedom crowd had to put up with during COVID. You know? Yeah,
incredible.
And it just carries on and carries on and carries on.
Well, Bob McCroskey couldn't even get his, what is a woman, you know, the definition of an actual woman ad in there.
Yeah.
Even though Hobson's Choice slipped in there somewhere. But you can bet you'll get a full page Pride ad in.
And the second word in cultural Marxism is Marxism. Right?
Yeah.
Everybody behaving in the same way.
Yeah, look him up and read about.
Yeah.
Oh dear. Okay, but that embedded in our legal system, though, that is where it can touch all of us directly, can't it? In the end.
Yeah, and I think we're seeing, and I could be wrong here, but if you know, being an outside observer, I think we're seeing that slowly now in England, right? And what the police are doing and behaving like over there, and there was just a guy, one of their, I don't know what you call him, the commissioner or something in London, the Met guy.
Yeah, the Met commissioner.
Yep.
Oh, the glasses.
On the TV just late last week or early, it might have been yesterday, whatever, you know, literally saying to Elon Musk, I don't care what you say on Twitter. If we find that it's breached English law in terms of it being offensive to a minority group or whatever, we will get you. You know? Yeah, and we saw it here in the Posey Parker thing with the police, and we saw it at the parliamentary protest, the police being ruled by the state to oppose any other views that the state didn't like, you know.
And their training, that you know, the training story that hit last week.
With the hate speech, exactly. Yeah, this is an example of hate speech. Someone having an opinion that's different than what the state puts forward.
And they're turning up at doors in the UK, you know, knocking on the doors, like you said something online.
Yeah, 100%. This is the cultural Marxism that Owen McShane probably spoke about 20-something years ago. It might have been George Orwell himself, you know, of New Zealand. He spoke about this a lot 20 or 30 years ago, and here we are now actually having to fight it.
All right, well, we're talking about it here at least. Nick, it's great to have you back. Thanks for your views on, you know, the two main topics there, the Te Pāti Māori proposed law on making decisions by the Waitangi Tribunal binding, and the Marine and Coastal Area Act. Good to have you back. All success with your new venture.
Thank you. And look, it's going to be great. And, you know, I because I'm now on my own, I can do whatever I want, so to speak. I've got no bosses. I'm the only boss. I was just saying to the wonderful people of Voices for Freedom just a week or so back that, you know, anything that comes up in kind of a public interest case, I'll be all bells in and trying to fight it. So it's something I can do because I've got an interest in sort of public interest type cases and stuff. So who knows where that will go. Lockdown number two, you know, you might find me on the front page of the bloody court with a high court case or something. That would be fun, wouldn't it? I can come back in and talk about it.
That'll be worth an interview.
Yeah, for cool. Sure.
All right, Nick, thanks for being on Legal Hub this week. We'll talk soon.
Thanks, Paul. Okay, mate. See you. Bye.
Right now, free speech is under heavy attack in New Zealand and overseas, with governments constantly devising new ways to enforce censorship. To make sure you never miss the critical news and breaking stories you rely on, join the RCR mailing list today. Get connected now at realitycheck.radio/email.